The conference committee will come to order. We have two things on our agenda today. The first is a presentation from Dr. Fazio, who was a very involved member with the Transformation Task Force in the discussions around payment reform. And the second is a presentation by the Department of Human Services around language that they've been looking at in regard to medical homes from the perspective of implementing it for public programs. So we'll start with Dr. Fazio and anyone he's brought with him who would like to come up to the table with him. And Dr. Fazio, I think the reason that we were especially interested in hearing your viewpoint is because of the very many discussions and the concerns that were shared among the task force about just doing baskets of care as a means of cost containment. And so thank you for arranging your schedule so you could be here today.
Madam Co-Chair, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the opportunity. Committee members, I'm Charles Fazio. I'm the Chief Medical Officer at Medica, and I had the privilege of serving on the task force last year. Madam Co-Chair, how long would you like this to take?
You have as much time as you need.
Oh, don't tell him that.
Okay. Well, seeing that Senator Abler's here, or Representative Abler's here, I'll try to shoot for 10 minutes.
Which,
I know is what he's fond of having testimony take. Just a couple minutes, if I could review sort of where we went and why the task force made the recommendations that it did. I think there was general agreement that the way we do things now isn't working. It's gotten us exactly where we are, and that's in a little bit of soup. So how do we move forward? The current system, obviously, a practitioner generally gets paid more for doing more, and there's not a lot of accountability as far as what you get paid based on quality or health in the population you serve. There are some pay-for-performance programs. There are some measures of quality and of cost in the public realm, but not a lot of tie-in between those two. We talked as an evolution of that towards talking about medical homes, and obviously there would be some advantage for a practitioner who were coordinating care for a person to be able to think about care differently, to have care not always have to be in the office, to have care be able to take place via the internet or by phone, not always have it have to be with a physician, even with an advanced practice nurse, with a physician's assistant, with other kinds of educators. So the medical home was designed to say, move away from the traditional model, do more coordination, do more sorts of outreach, and we need to pay you differently. Now, one of the concerns always was this can't just necessarily be more money over a system that was already costing us money, but how could it change the system a little bit so it became more efficient? So we talked about those medical homes. People then also started to talk about packages of care. So there are certain events that it makes sense occur sort of together. And why would you not look at paying for those packages of care as a unit to try to give some incentive for quality and for outcomes and for efficiency? So a good example might be somebody has hip pain. From the day they show up with hip pain until the day we decide they're either going to do well with medicines and actually are doing well or need a hip replacement, and they've recovered from that and are up and moving about again, what does that episode of care, what does that package of care cost? And how could practitioners find ways to be more efficient underneath of that package so that there would be some competition between organizations and between practitioners for being efficient with those packages? You could also think about the care that a person with diabetes needs in the course of a year as a package of care, and have some of the incentives around it, how healthy they were, how well they were living with their diabetes, and what they otherwise reported as their own interpretation of their health as success with that. And you could think about that as yet another package of care, and organizations could compete on being efficient and getting good health outcomes from those packages. Now, there's some downsides if we stop there, it seems to me. the package is due in sent efficiency within the package. But if I'm a consumer, if I'm a patient, how do I know how many packages I need? How do I know if I just need the diabetes package, if I have diabetes, or if I need a separate package because I have shoulder pain, or a separate package because I get a sore on my leg, which sometimes happens with diabetes? What if that sore goes on and eventually requires some kind of surgery? Do I need yet another package? So it might be confusing to the consumer to understand all of their packages. And even more concerning would be how much care takes place outside the packages. So we know we come to some definition of what's in the shoulder package or what's in the package for people with diabetes, but then there's thousands of codes, thousands of billable services outside of those packages, and we might well lose our efficiencies for all the things that are outside of those. It's, in essence, fee-for-service, the current system, outside of those packages. So that would be some concern if we stopped there. The other obvious work we'd have to do would be to define what's in the package. So what the task force thought was important is that we eventually get to a point where there was accountability for the total cost of care. Now, that's come to be called level 3. Some people have insisted that that's actually capitation, which is something that was pretty popular in this community in the 80s and into the 90s. But it's really not capitation. What people have talked about is accountability for the total cost of care, but not putting a provider at risk for those things that are actually more appropriate for the insurance realm. So, for instance, I put in a bid for care for somebody who has diabetes. It's for that whole person. It's not just their diabetes. I am concerned about their total cost of care for a year, and I might estimate what I could spend in that year to keep them healthy. If that person goes on, unfortunately, to have a car accident and exhaust their automobile benefits for medical services, that should not fall under the realm of their total cost of care payment. That's more of an insurance kind of a risk than it was a clinical risk associated with the person's life that I said I would care for. So it would seem to me that over time we could separate those kinds of risks. We could use risk adjusters that are much more sophisticated than they were 15 years ago in the heyday of capitation to help people figure out what might it cost to take care of a life, to take care of a person in this community for a year, and then have people actually compete to be more efficient under that. That was where we thought we should go. And underneath of that kind of a picture, packages are much more effective than they are by themselves. Because maybe if I'm accountable for the cost of keeping somebody healthy for a year, I might not even necessarily have them take care of their shoulder pain in my system. Because it might dawn on me over time that my system is more expensive than a different system that does a really nice job with people with shoulder pain. And that's where we saw the real advantage of packages of care beyond just existing by themselves, was when you were accountable for the total cost of care and you, the practitioner, had as much interest as the person with a high medical expenditure deductible in being interested in what the cost of care was. If it's just the patient who has to learn about the cost of care and be concerned about that, it is less effective than if the practitioner is interested in it too, in addition to the person's health. And so we thought what has become known as level 3 was the place that we ought to think about. I also know from some of my colleagues who work in rural communities that there's a lot of concerns that this causes everybody to want to join a big system and or it leaves people who are in rural communities out in the cold. Again, I don't think that is the case in either of those concerns, and let me tell you why. We can split up the cost of care based on analytics into what people use on an outpatient basis, what people use on an inpatient basis. It is possible to think about total cost of care in a lot of different ways and to think about it in terms of just what it is you might be accountable for and you might be able to influence. Now, I have shared with some of you, I spent 10 years in a rural community, 20 miles from a stoplight and 50 miles from a hospital. And we figured out how to get efficient care for our patients. We figured out who were the most efficient specialists, and we had the choice of three or four communities to use specialists, and we had what would look to a stranger like a very haphazard pattern of referral. But we knew we used orthopedics here, and we used urology here, and we used cardiologists here, because they were people who, in our experience, had done the best service for our patients, had supported our mutual care of those patients, and had evolved to be the people who served us as a community best over time. So I think an individual, even in a rural community, has a lot to say and a lot of influence over the care that their patients seek. And so even they could have something to do with the total cost of care in a rural community. You don't have to be part of the big system. You don't have to have all of the components of providing the total cost of care in order to influence it or to be successful under what the Transformation Task Force thought about as phase three. So we thought of that as one of the most important planks of the process, as important as the public health piece or anything else that was coming out of it. I don't know if that furthers the understanding of it, but yeah. And I also would like to tell you, I guess, separate from the task force, in my role at Medica, we have worked to bring five organizations along in a pilot of medical homes. We took some of the money that we used to invest in disease management, and we invested it in primary care practices to have them do what the people in the disease management programs were doing. We're only about 8 months into that, and so we're continuing to watch as it goes. But we're also in discussions with three other organizations about level three payment. And it won't be their entire organization or their entire book of business with Medica that goes off at the first time onto this level three pilot, but we are moving in that direction because I think the recognition across the community is the current system is taking us someplace we're not going to survive, and so we need to change the course. And so I think the most forward-thinking people in the community are thinking about level three payment.
Are there questions? Representative Huntley.
Well, Madam Chair, Dr. Fazio, I have 100 of them, but let me ask you about a physician that you know, and I know, and I won't give his name, but he has a small clinic, and he's an endocrinologist, does diabetics and people with obesity. That's basically all he does. And in some cases, he certainly would be considered a medical home, for those diabetics. How is he going to fit into a total cost of care kind of system? Because he's not in an integrated network at all.
Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, I think that's a good example. I think he could fit in and probably would end up fitting in two ways. If he wanted to be viewed as a medical home, if there were people who saw him as the person who was coordinating their care, it seemed to me he would have the opportunity to participate in that payment for total cost of care, shooting for a particular financial target and health targets in any given year for those people who wanted to view him as the primary coordinator. But I think in his role as an endocrinologist, he more often is going to serve as a consultation expert, as an expert in those areas, to another system of care, and come under the expenditures that they have for their total cost of care payment or bid, thereby hoping that he becomes more efficient so that he becomes the practitioner of choice for some system.
Representative Huntley.
Another follow-up. You talked about that your organization is already contracting with three different, or in the process of contracting with three different groups. How do you get away from the problem of a pilot project versus having a critical mass of patients to really change the way a provider operates?
Madam Chair,
Dr.
and
Fazio.
Representative Huntley. That's another great question and a concern for many organizations as they begin to think about their business differently. The way we hear that question more often is, if Medicare is never really going to change from fee-for-service, how do we talk to our group about behaving one way for their commercial business or some growing part of their commercial business and having to behave differently for their Medicare business? And what I'm hearing more organizations say is we need to make the change to thinking about efficiency and total cost of care. We need to figure out how to be profitable in that mindset, and then maybe as a community, we invite Medicare to come along. So, or look for some exemption to Medicare as a community to think about that payment differently. How then do you start to work on the commercial business? With a given organization, for instance, what if you, in a mixed specialty organization, what if you just took the internists to start with? I know one organization that wants to do that. Take their general internists, have them be part of the pilot, have them think about total cost of care, and let the other practitioners work differently. The internists happen to be geographically in a different site with people who just work with them. In another organization, you could just take one building, if it were a multi-site organization, and have them think about it differently. In a small organization, it's easier to take the whole organization and go.
Dr. Fazio, transition. If I can just interrupt you, I think the issue, as I understand what Representative Huntley's question is that if Medica is doing this with three organizations, but Medica is only 15% of their business, how do they get enough critical mass out of that to really be able to change the way they're providing care? Because the rest of their payments are coming the old way. Isn't just about Medicare. I think we all know Medicare is going to have to be brought along. But it is the rest of the payment system that we don't turn over to Medicare.
Madam Chair, great question. Again, different aspect, as you mentioned, of the same question. I'd like to hope Medica might be closer to 20% of their business. But anyway, two aspects of that. One, through ICSI, ICSI, we've been very successful with the depression initiative that's become known as DIAMOND, with having the health plans and the practitioners sit together and develop a model that the health plans could then go back and figure out how they were going to implement separately and not run too much risk that we were affecting competition by having that discussion together. You're right, it's very different if we have this discussion with three organizations about level three payment, but we have encouraged them to seek out the same conversation with other payers to see if they could get closer to a critical mass, and especially hopeful that there might be some government-funded business coming along to help that critical mass so we really could be thinking about this differently. But we know that they're taking a little bit of a chance just doing it with us. They know they're taking a little bit of a chance just doing it with us. But it's a place to start, and if both parties approach it as a win-win and you're not trying to have one of the parties be a loser in this, I think it's doable.
Dr. Fazio, if they are successful in reducing their costs and improving their quality, won't other providers that are sort of sitting on the sideline not thinking about doing this be put at a disadvantage over the long run?
Madam Chair, another good question. I'd like to think that it's not naive to think that the short answer to your question is no. I think over time, as we design benefits so that consumers and patients seek out the most efficient providers, that there will be some movement of patients if some providers continue to be much more costly relative to the average or to others. I also think when people start thinking about care differently, what my understanding is that their capacity for patients actually increases. If everything doesn't have to revolve around a one-on-one encounter with a physician, which it does right now because that's mostly the only way you get paid. I think you actually have capacity in your system for more people. So what we see over time, and I hope before too long, is that the providers who are willing to be more efficient, who are willing to think about care based on the total cost, develop more capacity, have patients begin to shift to them, which I hope changes the dynamic further.
Just one last question, Dr. Fazio. Don't you think that it would be better, rather than having individual organizations trying to negotiate sort of a different payment system with all of their payers, to have more of a structured set of rules that payers and providers knew everybody was going to acknowledge, especially for our rural providers that would, as you have described earlier, have to become involved in what we call virtual networks, so that they would understand how payment could be moved around within that kind of a system to advantage them changing the way they provide care.
Madam Chair, whole list of good questions today. I think the short answer is yes, and as with everything, not knowing completely how this might work leaves me with some caveats. In the current system, we can't afford to keep going the way we're going and have people who are getting less than the average payments all get up to average without anything else happening. And sometimes that's the effect of transparency, is nobody at the high end is too embarrassed about being at the high end, but everybody at the bottom would like to be further along. I don't have a great deal of concern about thinking about simpler ways of establishing payments, provided we also have caveats in there about how far the payments can go increase over any period of time. Because otherwise, it seems to me, we run the risk at some point that there's just some shadow pricing and everything moves up faster than it might move up otherwise, and we lose the incentive to have it actually go down.
Other questions? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Fazio, just kind of to that last point of, sort of you referred to shadow pricing, but, we have provisions for the single pricing and how do we kind of guide that forward in a way that does sort of balance out with this longer-term vision of a total cost of care, which is really based on efficiency, because setting that single price, it seems to me, is going to be a challenge for some providers.
Let's see, Madam Chair, Representative.
Dr. Fazio.
Could I ask you just to restate your question for me? I'm sorry, I didn't.
I think the way the bills start out, there is a composite price established. So people don't start out with a single price. They have a composite price figured out for them based on their share of business from each payer and how much each payer pays them. So getting to figuring out what your price should be based on what you've been getting paid on a composite basis won't be that difficult. Now, you might decide you don't want to be at that price. You'd like to figure out how to be more efficient so you could have a lower price, but I don't think providers establishing their price will be as difficult once they know what their composite price is compared to others who also will have composite prices that will be figured out and will be transparent. I think the issue for people who have composite prices is that our insurance payment mechanism today does not risk adjust. And the vision of getting to a price that is the same for everybody is that it would be a risk-adjusted price. And so providers that might be disadvantaged because they have medical education in their price, or they have a lot more uncompensated care in their price, or they have a lot more public payment in their price, those things are not those things are not risk adjusted for in our payment system today. They might be in a negotiated price, but they're not risk adjusted for. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, your description of the composite price I hadn't heard before, but that is a way to get to your single price. But my question was more about how do you evolve from that single price to the total cost of care, and in terms of providers putting together that total package and feeling like it's sustainable, particularly if the focus is on efficiency, which I always think should be a blend of both quality and cost, not one or the other. And so it's how do you envision that evolution, and does single price on its own add, do you think, some value as a standalone while we're developing the other provisions?
Dr. Fazio.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler. I apologize. I'm not sure I'm following the evolution of the language and the evolution of the bill over time. I think most people envisioned the single price coming at the point where we were at total cost of care. So I would offer that bid for the total cost of care for an adult life whose risk was one. And then we would figure out which people actually chose to use you as their medical home and what their risk was relative to one, and that would adjust how you were paid. And so the single price would, the single price could come over time as you move towards the accountability for the total cost of care.
Well, Dr. Fazio, isn't it true that really and truly as an insurance company or as a health plan, that is what you do today? You figure out, you negotiate prices with providers, and then you figure out what you think their utilization will be, and then you establish what your price is going to be. And if you're wrong, you have reserves to back you up, and then you adjust it to make that up the next year. But you really do that today. You don't just have everybody get paid prices and never have any idea how much it's all going to add up to in the end.
Madam Chair, I think in the general direction your comments are accurate. The distinction I would make, though, is that there's no accountability for units of service in the current volume. You negotiate a price and you try to help people understand what the risk of their patient group is, and then what other things you might do to keep the costs of healthcare in general down. But then there's no accountability within the current system for total cost of care, and that usually, even with severity of illness, is more around units of service.
Right. But, I mean, it's not like we're moving from one place to a totally different place. It is possible to figure out a total cost of care. It's not impossible to do.
Madam Chair, absolutely. It's actually relatively, I won't say easy. It is a reasonably accurate science which has evolved a lot in the last 15 years.
Other questions? Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two kind of different questions. The first one kind of building off Representative Loeffler's question, and I think you answered it partly, but if we were to go to a single price before we got to something like total cost of care, so when we're in the world that we currently exist in, or even a world just of healthcare homes, what's the impact of that in the market? So that, as opposed to the, you know, the insurance companies kind of do calculate this price, but the provider setting a price for everybody for a list of services, what impact do you think that would have in terms of costs in the system?
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen. I think you'd need somebody with expertise beyond mine to predict that. I think there's a pretty good chance we would get competitive pricing on common things that were available to most people or that people sought out. But as I understand it, there are thousands and thousands of procedure diagnostic codes, and people aren't going to look at every one of those. So it's not clear to me that one price necessarily lowers the rate of rise of healthcare costs without other changes to the system.
And one other question on the total cost of care issue. One of the concerns that's been raised is that one of the goals that we have, and one of the concerns that's been raised about our current system, is that there's no incentive. One of the incentives we lack now is the incentive to think into the future, to think long term. So to do things today, because it's going to avoid someone getting diabetes in the future, and there's no incentive there because that patient may be with a total other set of and a very different medical in a different care system 10 years from now when they'd actually get the onset of that. So you make the investment up front and you don't see any savings. You're kind of dividing risk and reward. What is their total cost of care if people can go out and rebid every year? Do the incentives change, or do we still have kind of this problem of because we're bidding year to year and people can change providers, that there won't be that economic incentive to do kind of those preventative things that avoid the onset of chronic disease later, because you don't know as a provider in the future if you're going to get, if that patient will be with you in the future. I don't know if that question is clear or not, but.
Madam Chair and Representative
Dr.
Thiessen.
Dr. Fazio.
It's actually an argument that we heard from employers for a long time about why not to invest in health. As recently as 5 years ago, employers made the same argument about why not to invest in smoking cessation, because by the time they got any benefits from it, that person would work somewhere else, not only be in a different healthcare system. I think there's a couple of aspects to it. Number one, people don't like changing their practitioner. There were studies, they're a little dated right now, but it took something on the order of $15 or $20 a month to get somebody to change their practitioner. I suspect that that number is higher now. It's a pretty old study. They tend to want to stay with a practitioner they have come to know and trust. I would think the issue of bidding year over year would have to do with competition across the community, and I hope you'd want to stay competitive in order to continue to attract new people to your system. And then also, I would think that over time, insurance benefits are already evolving and will continue to evolve to reward healthy people and to reward the systems in which they are working with measures of health, so that that partnership continues to be encouraged. And then I guess from a purely naive and theoretical point of view, if we don't start doing it as a community, we'll have unhealthy people going employer to employer and system to system rather than maybe people who are getting healthier. But that one never works.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, thank you for having Dr. Fazio here today. I could ask 100 questions, too, but I just have a few. So, Dr. Fazio, I am curious about the total cost of care concept. And in your early description, talked about it and insurance risk. And I'm just wondering if you could maybe tease that out for me just a little bit more. I'm interested in knowing how that gets decided. You know, what would fall into the bucket of total cost of care, and then what wouldn't be in there, and who would decide that?
Sure.
Dr. Fazio.
Chair. Representative, it's a good question, and I'm not sure I have the exact answer today, but I can talk to you about it in concept. Capitation, which what people want to compare this to capitation, that didn't work for a lot of reasons. Risk adjustment, even to total cost of care for 1 year, wasn't very good, not as good as it is now. People were in it to have winners and losers. And so you really could see, not as much in this community, but in some other communities on either coast where people did poorly in capitation. And then also, I think provider groups were not very experienced in managing under a total cost of care program, whether it was capitation or not. So all of those things have gotten better. In fact, in this community, while most capitation is gone, there are still some capitated products. Most of them are in the Medicare and the dually eligible realm. And there are some practitioners doing outstanding work in those programs, keeping people very, very healthy in their homes, in the community, and also managing to make money doing that. So there is some better experience under how to manage efficiently. The risk adjusters have gotten better. We know better how to predict who is at risk for getting ill and therefore to make adjustments in how people are funded, for instance, under the system. But then lastly, the last part has to do with how you define what's in the total cost of care. In insurance, there's lengths of stay in hospitals, for instance, that you call outliers. There's people who just get so sick that they're in a hospital much longer statistically, happens very commonly. It's possible to eliminate certain outliers, certain conditions from what you think of in the total cost of care. It is possible to put boundaries around what's included in the total cost of care. It's possible to put risk corridors in the total cost of care so that nobody wins or loses too badly when you think about how to do that. So haven't actually defined it in those three pilots we're doing. Those are the things we're still trying to figure out. We hope to have that done by June 1st. But those are some of the important things you have to go into. And again, if you go into it with an attitude that one party will win and one party will lose, you're probably going to be right.
Other questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I might be a little confused between what was payment level 2 and payment level 3 with this question, but we talk a lot about 5 or 6 chronic conditions. And when you look at it from the provider side or from the patient side, a number of those conditions will, you know, be in a person. They'll have diabetes and congestive, or they'll have coronary artery disease, et cetera. So when you think about total cost of care, all of those comorbidities would be in the bucket of the total cost of care. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that is correct. The total cost of care would be about a person and not about a condition or an event.
Madam Chair, just one more.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this last question I want to say is uncomfortable for me to ask, and it comes I want to ask you the question because I hear this question in relationship to this payment reform model. And so I'm wondering how you respond to the concept or the concern that people are expressing that if we move in this direction and have providers being responsible for the total cost of care, it will result in providers rationing care because they're concerned about their bottom line. And again, I want to make sure it is clear that that is not my view, but it is one that's being expressed and fairly regularly.
Dr. Fazio.
My actual concern would be if we don't do anything, that as a state or as a society, we're going to end up rationing care. We're going to have to decide at some point what we can afford to continue to pay for or what we would choose to continue to pay for if we don't figure out how to slow the train down at this point. One of the theoretical risks, anytime anybody is responsible for somebody's health under a fixed cost situation, is absolutely underuse. Just like under the current system, it is overuse. We have to worry about much more. Underuse is easier to find. It is the sort of thing that consumers are quick to bring to your attention. But it's also the sort of thing that would come out based on all the quality measures that we're talking about doing. You wouldn't have to underutilize services for too long to see that people in your practice with hypertension aren't controlled, or that people in your practice with diabetes aren't very well controlled, or that the people in your practice aren't getting mammograms or pap smears or whatever the health maintenance was that they needed. I suppose there could be some people who would approach total cost of care risk by thinking they should do less. But the community, I think, is ready with the support of ICSI and Minnesota Community Measurement and all kinds of other investment to say we can approach the total cost of care by innovating underneath that total cost, and by looking for ways to become more efficient by getting health professionals to work to the limit of their license rather than having it all have to go through doctors, and by just thinking about care differently. And there's just not enough urgency in the current system to force people to do that. And if we evolve over a few years to something that's paid differently, it seems to me the incentives are different.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Other questions? Representative Abler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Fazio, nice to see you again. It's been a good discussion, I think. And actually, you and I have shared a career in different parts of this whole niche, and I appreciate your comments. I have a couple comments and a question, I think, at the end of it. But I, as we talk about this whole thing, I spent a good deal of time thinking about this, as most people in the room. I think there's some assumptions we want to keep in mind and some status of how it is we need to remember that provider intercommunications are lousy already. And this coordination of care that people talk about is not always done as practically as we think, and Dr. Fazio knows that. And you know, yeah, they saw the neurologist. What did the neurologist do? I don't know. And to get the records, you haven't got time. And so you repeat the tests and so on, that the concept of total cost of care is foreign to almost every provider because they live in this little island of this niche. And I think that as we promote this idea, I think even promoting that is going to help. If you help doctors understand where they stand in the continuum of this person's care as a concept would be revolutionary. I think in this best practice, evidence-based stuff, I think there's little agreement in the system on what the best way to do various things are. And I think you've got a, and we've talked about that in my division before, and the clinician said, that's just too hard to put that together. And I think those are really fundamental things that underlie all the work we're attempting to do here. And I was a little amused. You were good level three providers will get more volume, more efficiency. That was the HMO argument. Remember, we more, you know, we'll be efficient and you have more patients. You'll get a little bit less money, but don't worry, it'll make up in volume. Do you remember that, Dr. Fazio, in the 80s? Just that was an effort at humor there. But great savings for the system this level three provides. And there's some assumptions I wanted people to remember, too, is that doctors are provided, they're motivated by money. And I suppose a few are, but that's not why they go to work. And I think that these bonuses that we offer will be less motivating than we think because they mostly want to do good work. But I also think if we take their money away, that they're not going to voluntarily agree to that either very readily, and that's important. And I think the average provider does not know what they even get on a visit because of all the twisted payment systems that we're under. I have no idea what people pay me for a visit. I couldn't tell you on the average person. And as we design this system and work together, I hope, to come up with something that we do, we have to remember all those parts. Medica, you represent them. We get pre-authorized. Our little niche of the cheapest providers get pre-authorized because nobody else will put up with it. But the form got changed in January that we have to fill out for you all to a different pre-authorizing entity. It took my little clinic 2 months to figure that out, just so you know that this doesn't turn on a dime. And you know all that, too, Doctor. And we can design anything we want to do, but doesn't mean it can be built or implemented like we hope, or that the costs will come, the savings will come as quickly as we hope. And I just want people to remember that as we go forward with all these ideas. But my question is, and I hope you see those as being well-intended, because you want to have a system that remains intact after we do these changes to it that it certainly needs. And you can't pay people as peace workers, doctors as peace workers, and hope you're going to come out in the money part of it. You were talking about those pilots. Could you discuss those a little bit more? I think that you can see where my comfort level is being driven toward in a series of pilots. Could you talk about what you expect to see out of your pilots and how long it's going to take to show some of the savings that you're hoping to do in your own niche?
Sure.
Dr. Fazio.
Representative. Let me tell you about the medical home pilots first, and then I'll tell you about level three payment pilots. With the medical home, the pilot was two-phase. First, we looked at the group's ability to deliver care to people with chronic conditions, and we made sure that they had the infrastructure and the people in place to do it well. When there were holes in that infrastructure, we gave them a grant to fill in the holes, whether that was with having a registry so they keep track of all their patients or hiring an advanced practice nurse to do some of the calls and some of the outreach. And then we took money that in the past would have been invested by the health plan in disease management, and we paid that on a per-person, per-patient, per-month basis to the clinic, basically to do outreach, care coordination, any of the things we think of as disease management in helping people close gaps in care and helping people to be healthier. So our measures will be all the things we typically measure around diabetes and that are on, for instance, the community measurement website. But then there'll also be patients' perception of health and patients' perception of the system and how that compares with other pilots, other programs we have in place. And then we'll look at cost of care for those people for a year relative to other people with diabetes in the system. We think it'll be lower. Level three is similar, except we're going to look at the payments differently. So, for instance, we'll take one organization potentially, and they might have all of their internists work in the same building. And what we might do with them, since they're already good at capitation, is identify all the patients from Medica who use those 10 internists as their medical home. Figure out what the risk-adjusted total cost of care is for those people in a year, and pay 1/12 of that total to that practice on a monthly basis, regardless of how many encounters there are, and potentially have some sort of a gain sharing with that group at the end of the year if those people end up even healthier than they had been in the past.
Madam Chair, just one more.
So the total cost, I appreciate that. I appreciate that your work there. And it'll be, and I just, well, I have two questions. The comment part of my question is that I would expect that the total cost of care would range from $20 per person to $10,000 per person for a year. Is that, and would you pay them accordingly as your risk? Like, I don't use a lot of care, but I have family who do. Would that be how you would do that on the level three? Would it be that broad of a range?
Madam Chair. Dr. Fazio.
Representative. Short answer is yes. The biggest risk people are the people who don't show up in any given year and then show up the next year,
yeah.
As a lot of the young healthies do. But for people in the system, it might well be that there's that range. Now, once we get to somebody who's using $10,000 or more dollars of care in a given year, they might get to the definition we were talking about earlier about somebody that the clinic doesn't want in that risk pool, or we talk about differently, or we put some limit on the risk depending on what it is that's driving the cost that high.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Thiessen.
And this is more of a response a little bit. We often think about when we're talking about providers as a single doctor working with a single patient, and we start talking about whether people are motivated by money or not. And I know there's a lot of doctors who aren't motivated by money, just like there's a lot of lawyers who aren't motivated by money, believe it or not, and small business people, and that's true. But the thing I think we miss a lot of times when we talk about these financial incentives is that those individuals are working inside a business for the most part in Minnesota. They're working in a large clinic system. And so it's not really, the focus ought not to be on whether an individual doctor is going to be motivated by the money or not. It's whether the system is motivated by the money within which they work. And that there's no question that those systems are motivated by the money. They wouldn't be asking for 18% increases in reimbursement rates this year over last year if they weren't motivated by money. And so I think it's important that we frame this question up the right way as we think through how this works, and we make sure we are thinking of the right image and metaphor in our head, which is not just the individual doctor working with the individual patient, but the fact that we live in a state where most medical professionals work in a business and in large businesses for the most part, which are motivated. So getting the financial incentives right, I think, can make a really big difference in how we go about doing this and in reducing the cost of care. And one other thing I would just say in terms of the lawyer thing, there are actually models out there where lawyers operate under a total cost of care system. There's a thing called prepaid legal services, for instance, where people sign up and they get a year's worth of legal services for a flat fee. And so this model does work in a whole variety of professions. And That's more, well, that's for what it's worth. But I just think that that's important that we keep that in mind as we move forward here.
Are there other questions? Representative Huntley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Dr. Fazio. I probably should save this for Dr. Schiff, but I had an interesting discussion this morning with another member of the legislature who is been in the same healthcare system for many, many years and has practically never seen the same physician twice. And so my question is on a medical home. My experience is completely different. I don't know if it's the Twin Cities or what. I know Diane Loeffler has talked about this many times, but I've had the same physician for 20-plus years. And sure, there's some times when I go and he's not available and I see somebody else, but most of the times it's the same physician. Is that built into what you're doing on medical homes?
Sure.
Dr. Fazio.
Again, short answer, absolutely. It's built in. One of the key components of continuity is that there is somebody who understands me as a patient who, on a regular basis, helps me coordinate what it is that I need to do. There were some interesting studies done first in California in the 80s that a number of groups took note of in this community in the 90s having to do with the chaos in a medical organization that comes when you have to see somebody different every time. What happens is that the person you see that day just wants to get you through that encounter, figure out what it is that day, but they don't have the bigger picture in mind. And you have to get back to that person that understands you, the person you think of as your medical home, to sort of revisit what goes on that day and hopefully make some progress forward with what otherwise has gone on. In the practices in the community that looked at that exact thing and figured out how do we get people on a regular basis in with their own practitioner, there's fairly dramatic changes in patient satisfaction and actually in the number of visits it takes anybody in a given year to stay healthy, because that one person acting as your medical home is much more efficient than the chaos when you're out in the system sort of randomly. So it's a huge part of what we see as a transition. And I think what the practitioner community sees as the transition.
Other questions? Representative Abler.
Yeah, the one I forgot to ask. Dr. Fazio, the Level 3 pilot, you thought there would be some idea on the medical home pilot, and maybe a year you'd see what kind of savings you have, et cetera, quality outcomes. How about the Level 3? Is it the same time frame, or do you have an idea about what that might show or when?
I'm sure. Representative. In the ideal world, it's a year to 15 months, so you understand 15 months probably to understand what happened in that year as claims and other experiences run out. That isn't necessarily going to stop us from moving on other pilots. We see these as works in progress. We'll assess how we're doing probably every quarter with all of these for everybody's comfort and continue to look for other willing partners.
And Madam Chair.
Representative Abler.
Just to thank you. And I expected answers like that. And in all this, they're going to take this pilot they have, they're going to feed into the next pilot and improve the model and improve that model. And I think in a couple of years, they'll have some models that are really pretty good. And so, I hope people understand my motivation here. It's not to get in the way of the work, but to point out that we must be cautious as we proceed, because you might find yourself going on a track that's entirely wrong. As the pilots, they're not turning their whole system into a bunch of level threes. They're starting with a small group and trying it out, and they're going to feed back, and how did that go? And so I think as we move along that there's great wisdom in a lot of these kind of pilots. Alina talked about wanting to do New Ulm as a pilot because they insure so many people there, and what a great idea as long as New Ulm doesn't mind that. And I think that there's other projects like that that are amenable to that. So that's just a thought to offer.
If I can just add a comment to that thought, Representative Abler, and that is that my concern all along has been that those providers that more or less have integrated systems today can do this without a lot of change being made by the legislature. And I would expect, although I don't know for sure, that the people you're talking to now are involved in an integrated payment system of some kind. What I worry about is people who aren't and how they find a framework in which they can structure their practice differently, share savings that might be generated out of reduced hospitalizations in a way that makes this possible for them to go forward and reduce costs and be competitive in the future. And I am not so sure that that can just spring up out of nowhere. And I know for sure that the pilots that we had that were involved in providing cardiac care, somebody saved money because there were 80% fewer people hospitalized. But I know for sure that the providers that were saving the money didn't get any of it. And so that just leads me to believe that this is not just going to be a happy kumbaya deal out there in the real world in terms of how people move forward with this, and that there really would be, there would be benefit to having some structure around it to help providers that otherwise are capable of forming virtual networks but do not have any mechanism to, in the payment system we have today, to have any benefit from it. Dr. Fazio.
Madam Chair, if I could comment on that. I think your points are well taken. Two of the organizations we're working with are larger, and I'll give one of them credit for the foresight of figuring out that internally they have to pay practitioners differently if this experiment is going to be successful. But one of the organizations is actually much smaller, and they feel like as a smaller organization with the ability to be more nimble and to change faster, they actually have the ability to come into a program like this and be quite successful very quickly. And I don't know that I'm going to be successful, but my goal with the next one is to have it be rural, the next group we bring on, so that we can come back at some point and tell people that that works too.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Dr. Fazio. This has been fascinating. Just following up on Senator Berglund's question about sort of how does it evolve and the human nature of things, as we're getting people to form these teams, care teams across disciplines, primary care, hospital-based care, other care, do you have guidance to offer us in terms of that human nature issue of who has the power and who is sort of how you create those governance structures? The healthcare industry in general has been tilted, I think, in, within hospital settings towards the high-end specialists because they're the revenue generators. The primary care have just sort of been, you know, the partnerships there haven't evolved over time to, I think, an equal peer-to-peer sort of relationship and a sharing of the books sort of relationship across the people outside the hospital and the people inside. As we look, go forward to this, are there things that we can do to facilitate that, that building of strong partnerships where people will share and look at and discuss honestly about changing payment streams, about practice patterns? And have you put some time into that as you think through these pilots?
Madam Chair,
Dr.
Representative.
Fazio.
Good question. I think we would... I'm not sure if we'd be surprised or not to know that an awful lot of practitioners already know a lot of what they'd need to know to be successful under level three. They know the people they use in consultation who are efficient. They know the people who are quick to image and those who are not. They know the people who are quick to operate and those who are not. They know the people who share patients well and return patients back with plans of care and those who don't. So from that point of view, if you had a vested, even more of a vested interest than you have now in making sure that people got to those people that you viewed as quality, effective, efficient practitioners, I think a lot of this would happen on its own. Part of what I think would help facilitate it would be more transparency, more measures of practice, that we have people, both practitioners and the public, become aware of. I think that's been something the community has been moving towards in general, but we don't have quite as much of it, especially in specialty areas, as we maybe could use. But I think a lot of this would shake out in the practitioner community of its own.
Other questions? If not, we thank you very much for taking time out of your schedule to be here with us today.
Appreciate the chance to be here.
This has been a helpful discussion.
Thanks.
Dr. Schiff and others that he's bringing with him from the Department of Human Services.
Madam Chair, my name is Jeff Schiff. I'm the medical director of the Department of Human Services, and with me today is Susan Castellano, the director of Maternal Child Health Quality Assurance. We appreciate the opportunity to speak to this group about the healthcare home parts of the legislation. That relates to DHS, yes.
Because there are two parts in the bill, I think it's important to distinguish.
We see the healthcare home aspects of legislation as transformational change in healthcare delivery that builds on the primary care system. There are some things we know about primary care that are quite significant in its positive effects on the healthcare system. These include decreased morbidity and mortality, fewer tests being conducted on patients, higher patient satisfaction, lower overall costs, and important for the Department of Human Services, decreased disparities. The legislation that's proposed represents a new opportunity to enhance primary care in Minnesota. It builds on the provider-directed care coordination legislation that was funded last year that provides an opportunity for the department to set up care coordination for the fee-for-service patients that are served by the public programs. We believe that that this legislation, along with the legislation passed last year, provides an opportunity for real practice change, and believe that in order for that to happen, several things need to occur. The requests that we make on behalf of our patients of primary care practices need to be robust enough that they produce the real results we're seeking, that we need to be able to measure results both in terms of quality and cost, and in terms of quality, in terms of patient satisfaction and engagement, utilization of resources, and health outcomes. And we believe that this primary care payment reform that's envisioned by healthcare homes creates the opportunity for a market amongst primary care providers. Over the past approximately 7 months, a group at sponsored by the Department of Human Services has met to outline criteria for the provider-directed care coordination. And we believe that these criteria are important in order to have successful transformation at the primary care level. They include care plans for individual patients with complex illness, registries so that a whole practice's population can be managed, a dedicated care coordinator who has the time and space to work on the coordination of care, engagement of families and patients both in their own care but also in the quality improvement at the practice level, and practice-level quality improvement. For patients who have to navigate the complicated healthcare system, primary care providers offer an opportunity to be agents for those patients in navigating the system, and can be very effective agents. That work, as we all know, is not currently funded, except in the funding that was passed last year. This will require, and we understand that this will require practice level change. Because practices have not inherently been funded or had the capacity to do this work. To that end, DHS and the Department of Health support providing a model of learning collaboratives to make this this transformation possible. I want to address a few other specific concerns and highlight a few other specific things in legislation, and then have the opportunity to turn this over to Ms. Castellano. Specifically, the language that we support, we have some concerns that language that names a national accrediting organization may not be adequate to create the transformational change we want. From the children's medical home model that a robust set of criteria will be required. We also believe that for the providers in Minnesota to make the change necessary, they need a common message about what criteria will be requested of them. For providers to get a different message for Minnesota's fee-for-service population, a different message for managed care, a different message for private insurance, creates a lot of discord amongst providers and in the end dilutes our ability to adequately affect change. And last, I think the thing that I would like to point out is that a medical home model moves beyond diagnosis-specific disease management. And although we measure quality results of some specific diseases because those parameters are available to us, it's very important that we consider medical home as a way of managing a whole person's care, especially for the complex patients that are served in the public programs. Thank you.
Thank you.
There's members. My name is Susan Castellano. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Human Services, and I'm going to make a few specific comments on the language that's currently in the bill.
Actually, we thought you were going to give us new language. Am I not correct in my understanding of that?
It is our hope, and that's something that we're working on internally and hope to get to you in the very near future, Madam Chair.
But it isn't available for us to look at today.
Not today, I'm sorry.
When you say near future, what does that mean to you?
It means I don't have a specific date to give you. I'm not sure, just internally when that will be available.
Well, we are beginning to work under a very tight timeline here. So my thought in having you come before us today was to... It doesn't do us very much good to spend our time spinning our wheels, comparing our versions of this, if you all are coming up with a third version, that we might as well just cut to the chase here and get to the third version and see if we have any questions or concerns about the third version. And so I was hoping that that could happen here today.
Madam Chair, I agree, and I think... I think some of what you're hearing us say is that we're very supportive of this bill and that we really don't see a need for a lot of change to this bill. We have a few suggestions that we want to forward to you, but we're very pleased and happy with the expertise and the work that you all have put into this bill, and we like the language a lot. So that's okay. The very short version of what I was going to say. I don't know if you want me to continue with the long version of what I was going to say.
Well, that's a little bit helpful. At least we're not going to be in a whole new book. We'll be on somewhat of the same pages. Do you want to share with us any concepts that you're trying to work on that would change what we have before us?
Madam Chair, I would like to do that, and I think the next several points that we'll hit on, including the one that Dr. Schiff referenced with regard to NCQA, sort of do hit the high points of what you might eventually see coming from us. And with that, one of the differences that's in the between the Senate bill and the House bill is that both bills refer to providing medical home for folks with complex and chronic conditions, and the Senate language goes on to add and those at risk of developing. And we do have some concerns about exactly how to implement that. I mean, I think
if I can just clarify, what the
please.
Senate is trying to get at is that there should be assessments done to determine if all of the chronic conditions that somebody has have actually been identified, because there's a lot of folks out there that might have mental illness, and that's been identified as a chronic disease and a disabling condition to them. But they might have a number of other chronic conditions that have not been identified or diagnosed. Mm-hmm. So just to be clear, since you're working on this, mm-hmm. that is what we were trying to get at, mm-hmm. to make sure that we don't just say, oh, well, you're in the Medicaid fee-for-service program, you must have a chronic condition, so go find yourself a medical home. It was to make sure that we are up front when we establish the medical home, getting some sort of an assessment of what all of the chronic conditions are so that medical home can be successful.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. And
or if somebody who has a chronic condition is at risk of developing a second chronic condition, so that that chronic condition that might develop could be presented.
Senator Berglin, that's helpful clarification, and I appreciate it. I think the way we were reading the language, and I do understand your intent there, and there is the other section that addresses comprehensive assessment, which I assume is addressing that same concern that you have.
Well, that is more for the general population, not this population.
Okay. Right. So that's helpful to know, and maybe we can take that into consideration as we look at drafting the language. Thank you. One of the other points that we wanted to applaud, actually, in the legislation is the fact that it addresses not only the fee-for-service but managed care population. We think that that it's important to include managed care enrollees because of the critical mass issue that actually you've both raised earlier today, which is that if providers are going to go to the work of being certified and learning how to provide this medical home model, that it makes sense that they provide it to, in fact, all of our clients as opposed to a subset of our clients. And I will mention as a by the way that in the MDH project that they currently have going on, medical home for children with special health care needs, in fact, of the Medicaid children who are in that population, about 50% to 60% of them are in the managed care enrolled children. So it is a significant portion of the population who I think needs to receive these services. We also would like to request or work with you on language for alternative models for dual eligibles and those in some of our programs like MSHO and MDO, where we have models of some kind developed already in coordination, and we want to work to make those medical home friendly, so to speak, and we'd like a language in the bill to allow for those alternative models as we develop them. We also would like to applaud the language in that it really, I would say that nationally there seems to be a lot of differences in the way medical home or patient-centered medical home or healthcare home or whatever term you would like to use is getting defined, and I think definition is actually critical. We at the department think how this gets defined is as important as anything in making sure that it works well, and I think you've achieved the right balance of ensuring that better quality care and the right care is being delivered, as opposed to just paying for something that's maybe not truly a difference in the way that care is delivered. The other issue, let's see, there was one more I wanted to talk about. Oh, and so I think you've done a good job on that point of making sure that it's not siloed and disease-specific. We encourage the idea of addressing care for the whole individual as opposed to listing out particular conditions when people may, in fact, have a number of health problems and their care should be addressed holistically. And I think that is about all that I wanted to cover. Are there questions from
questions,
the
Representative Abler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Castellano and Dr. Schiff, some of us got to spend glorious 2.5 hours with the governor talking about some of this stuff. We spent a good deal of time on this section, I think, because it was page one, and so we didn't get too far beyond it, of the draft. The governor had some interesting questions he was asking, and is what you're going to tell us reflective of that, or are you and he in communication with what he's going to bring to us? Is that going to be what he likes, or is there going to be another round of that after he reads the next version?
Representative Abler, that is, yes, we are in conversation with the governor on his concerns and issues with the legislation, and we will be presenting you something that fits both with the department's concerns and the governor's concerns.
And if I can continue with, so is there more concerns than what you said that are going to come out of the language you're going to submit to us, or is that pretty much what the changes are going to amount to?
Representative Apler, I believe that we've addressed the major points. I think there are a few minor language issues here and there, but I think we've pretty much hit the high points.
Thanks.
Other questions? Representative Huntley.
I have a couple, Madam Chair, for either one. The NCQA definition of what a medical home is, in my personal view, that would be the base, because we're trying to prevent providers from having to fill out a million different forms for the same issue. But so if you could work on something where that's the base, but if we want to add things on top of that, that's fine. My first question would be actually about coordination of care. And how do we mandate, I hate to use the word mandate, but that primary care physicians and specialists actually talk to each other rather than just have the patient come and nothing ever gets back to the primary care doc.
Oh, yeah.
Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, what part of the criteria that we've worked on at the department for provider-directed care coordination envisions that problem, and I think it's a universally accepted challenge. What we really have asked is that the care coordinators at the healthcare homes take that as their responsibility of communicating back. What we found in the pediatric model is that by creating a small but mass of providers who are interested taking care of complex patients, it has made and making requests from a group of primary care providers in the medical home collaborative, it has created a sensitivity from the specialists to be more responsive around these concerns. And when providers get, for example, a fax back form, and they get one from six or seven different practices that ask for an immediate response about what you're doing with my patient, the providers, the specialists sort of get the picture that they have some responsibility. So in some ways, we've relied on the primary care physicians in the medical home to retrain and to engage in the specialists. And the specialists have been very eager to do that. So I want to, if I may, I'd like to just make a quick comment about NCQA as well.
Go ahead.
We have spent some time looking at the NCQA criteria, and we appreciate that it represents a national body that's put some thought into criteria. However, it also represents, as you said, a sort of a floor in that a lot of the criteria in the NCQA are processes that could be put in place at a practice that don't necessarily have to. We want to make sure that the process that it could put in place for this to be a robust change that we fund in Minnesota actually create a change in the way the provider and the patient interact. And that's one concern we have, that the NCQA criteria don't create a high enough floor for that sort of interaction. And the second thing we're concerned about with NCQA is that we really believe that providers and patients specific patients need to sit together and work on improving the quality at the practice level to make a significant difference. And that's another thing that we support that is not currently in the NCQA.
That one last one.
Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair, and either one, the same question I asked Dr. Fazio. How would we ever get to the point where we either paid or somehow encouraged, in this case, medical homes to use the same physician for the same patient rather than seeing a new doc every time you go?
Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, one of the things we envision in the healthcare home is that a care plan will be created for everyone who has a complex illness. And that care plan will be available to anyone in that practice who sees that patient. I think that the challenge and what we'd like to see and is that the patient sees that value. There's increased access, and one of the things that a lot of medical homes have done is increase the access for patients with complex illness to that specific provider. We hope that through better information exchange within the practice and through increased access, that'll happen. We have not envisioned rules to require some percentage of that right now.
Well, and Doctor, you know, the thought that I've had about this is that, I mean, it's kind of a chicken and an egg thing here. You've got to get people, providers, to be healthcare homes.
Right.
You can't say to all your clients out there, oh, well, you've got to go find a healthcare home, and we don't necessarily have one for everybody. So we have to get the healthcare homes to become available.
Right.
And then it seems to me that whether people are using or taking advantage, as they should, of that opportunity becomes sort of a secondary discussion. And you know, if this does, as Dr. Fazio suggested, he believes it will, reduce costs in our healthcare system, then perhaps we would have the ability to talk about things like patient incentives, maybe reducing or eliminating co-pays, or other things that people with chronic diseases would be interested in as a result of being able to fully take advantage of a healthcare home, but you have to get them before you can have that part of the discussion, I believe. So in case anybody thought if we pass this bill this year that we're done talking about it, we aren't. We will continue to have more things to discuss. Representative Abler.
And Madam Chair, to that point, and I have a question. There are some of the safety net providers are doing some of this stuff now, I think, and I hope there's a way to make sure the bar isn't too high for them, at least initially, to be able to give these sites that can provide some of the care we want for the group of people who are the low-income ambulatory MA population, which I think that is a hard-to-serve population anyway. And so I hope that as the department creates its desire for a high bar and as some of the members of the conference committee want a high bar, that we recognize the realities of some of these operations are running on a shoestring, and they're already doing much of what we hope they would do. And if you gave them the $50 a month, that would be the marginal difference that would actually make them be very successful. And so, and I know that they're part of the discussion and that they're at the table at various times, and I hope we listen to their voices on the and that maybe even an evolutionary standard, we start at a bar and then over time we see what we really need to have. I appreciate that. And a second question about the consistency between the fee-for-service and the PMAP programs. I understand why the department would like that. It seems like it's a smart idea to me. Is there some pushback from the plans as to wanting to do it consistently across the board, or is that just a no-brainer, everybody's cool, and they'll just do what we want, and it can be exported universally?
Madam Chair, Representative Abler, I can't speak for the plans directly. They may have some concerns about that. I'm not sure. I'd hesitate to comment on that.
Other questions?
Well, Madam Chair, just to follow up, it seems like if they have a concern that they should, if this is, it seems like it'd be smart to have a home be a home, not that a Medica home is different than a fee-for-service home, different than a, you know, something else. And is that an issue, do you know? Or?
Representative Abler, that is one of the reasons that we have this bill.
Yeah.
And our goal is that we would have healthcare homes that have compatible and similar definitions. And, you know, so we should keep that in mind.
Thank you.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kind of in the same line, the bills, as you, I'm sure, more than no, I have differences, the House and Senate versions. And in particular, there's some language about developing health care homes, certifying health care homes. There are differences in the bills about who is in charge of that. And I wondered if perhaps you could address whether the Department of Health or DHS or if you have a recommendation or if, in fact, on this piece that we're going to be expecting in the very near future to come, if their recommendations are in that or if you can address it here.
Madam Chair, Rep. Sim Thornton, we have been in close contact with the health department around this bill as well as the fiscal notes associated with it, and I think both departments are very happy with the way that the responsibilities are jointly assigned. I think it's appropriate, as the bill envisions, that this would be spread not only to the state public programs but beyond that, that, of course, the health department be involved, not to mention the fact that they have the expertise in having run the medical home project from their agency for the last 4 to 5 years now. And I don't believe, no, I don't think any of the language that we would be proposing would, in fact, recommend that there be changes to that. There may be one slight exception around development of rates. I think there's a spot or two where it has the health department and the Department of Human Services developing the rates for our programs, and we would typically do that in consultation with them, but ultimately that's usually our responsibility.
Madam Chair, if I could.
Representative Norton.
And when you talk about you support the language in the bill, since we're still working on two separate bills, is there a particular one you're referring to? Are you speaking of the Senate language or the House language or something that you're working on separately?
Madam Chair, Representative Thornton, what I believe in, with regard to the duties of the commissioners, both bills are fairly similar, if not exactly the same. It leaves the responsibilities for the development of medical home and the definitions and that sort of thing to both commissioners, and I believe it's written that way in both bills.
Okay, that's your preference anyway. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Castellano or Dr. Schiff, I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit more about the alternative models and allowing those models to be medical home friendly. If you can just expound on that a little bit.
Sure. I'm Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, I'm not the expert on this. Pam Parker would probably be the best person to be sitting up here talking about this. But there are, as you know, some innovations that have occurred in the MSHO program where we're using Access Health to do some types of coordination for folks with who are dual eligibles. And that sort of thing. And we just want to make sure that we don't accidentally disassemble those programs, which seem to be working, but maybe try and help them become medical home friendly and adopt some of the principles of medical home and extend the work that they're currently doing as opposed to accidentally taking them apart by passing this legislation. I think there's a concern that folks may be receiving those kinds of services and then get a phone call saying, you should be in a medical home, and the enrollee would say, you know, what does that mean? And I thought I was, and that type of thing. So we want to be sure that we handle those situations appropriately.
Right. But on the other hand, there should be a time when we move beyond what we have been doing, mm-hmm. because by necessity, the MSHO program has taken, you know, I imagine in the beginning around 100, and it's grown to around 600. People in our medical assistance program who have disabilities, and you know, because of the sheer number, the health plan has been doing the duties of the care management among the providers. No provider had enough critical mass to expect them to do it themselves. Mm-hmm. But as we get more critical mass for providers, I think the real question is how do we transition away from that to having providers themselves be doing the care management? And so I think that's the question that needs to be answered. I don't think anybody wants to, you know, prematurely dismantle what we have going because it certainly is working better than nothing. Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, if I can just comment, I think that the folks who are involved in MINDO are certainly very aware of the development of the Medical Home Project and the integration with primary care. And I think, and I know the folks inside the department are also looking at, as you said, the development of capacity around this, of this being linked to integration of those programs with what we're working towards.
Other questions? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one more. And this, I think, for Dr. Schiff, you know, you've been at this for a little while. And so I just want to do a gut check with you and understand what you think are the most significant measures we can adopt that will actually change the practice, right? Because this is really about a change in how we care for people.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, I've had the pleasure, along with Susan, to be involved in the medical home project since 2004 when it was started for children. And I think that what we have really found in the innovators who've been in this practice, so there are now 26 practices, and some have been in about 10 of them have been at it for about 4 years, is that the development of a practice-based team that looks at quality improvement at that practice and tries to improve the care, and that practice team, including, in the case of pediatrics, parents, has been the most significant driver. As I have the pleasure often of introducing new teams in that collaborative, and one of the things I often say is that the parents are really the fuel to make practice change. And I think Don Berwick, the from IHI, also says that our patients are our most unutilized resource in healthcare transformation. So I think if I had to say a single thing that was most important, it would be that. And then just to add one other thing that I mentioned earlier is learning collaboratives seem sometimes like a far off thing to promote for the state, but other states have actually started to do this. We find the learning collaborative is a very normalizing experience to develop capacity around this. And so I think I'll just stop there, but I think those are two really important components.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Schiff, as you sort of look at this evolving, I'm just kind of thinking about the various components of our MA population, and I can see where this works for our very severely disabled people. We have a large group of elderly, but we also, within the transitory MA population, have a lot of people with chronic health conditions, too. And are there unique things that you think need to be built into the model as you apply it to public program enrollees for those people who are on typically less than 2 years or in and out? They might be on MA for a while. They stabilize their life, whether it's mental health or whatever the challenges that they face. They go off into employment. Somehow something doesn't work. There's this kind of back and forth of a large group of people, and how do you see this evolving to that long-term relationship and continuity so we actually are helping people stabilize their lives, both in terms of their health as well as other aspects? And is there something unique about the model we would implement through the DHS programs that might or might not fit within the more privatized programs?
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, when you asked the question, I thought about the Neighborhood Health Care Network, which really has had great diabetes results in their disparities collaborative. And one of the things that they have done in that collaborative is that they've made sure that they track or help track the eligibility of the members who have diabetes so that they don't lose their insurance. And although that's not a part of the medical home criteria that we've developed, I think it certainly is a part of what an organized system could do. The other thing I'll just say is that although the patients are transitory to the insurance program sometimes, a lot of the community-based clinics have a very large, sometimes approaching half or over half of their patients who don't have any insurance. So the patients may be transitory to us in insurance, but they're not transitory to the providers. So I don't know that the providers, most providers, when they see a patient, are not aware of who's the insurance. I suspect that they would continue to provide this care.
And there are other parts of our bills that are trying to make it easier for providers and health plans to keep people from falling through the cracks in terms of our insurance programs. So hopefully we don't have quite as many who end up being on and off and on and off again.
Excuse me.
And I think oftentimes even when an individual goes from a public insurance program to a private insurance plan, they keep the same doctor, especially if they have a chronic disease and they feel like Absolutely. They're getting good results. So that's why, again, it's important that we have this framework that reaches across payment sectors to make sure everybody is doing this and everybody's doing it more or less within the same framework. Other questions? Well, we know you'll let us know as soon as you have something in writing for us.
Won't be long.
To talk about. And in the meantime, we thank you very much for coming today to help discuss this a little bit more. At least we're all within the same framework here. We're not talking about a radical departure from what has been discussed in each body of the legislature.
Thank you for inviting us, Madam Chair.
I think we have no other business before us today, and so with that, we will adjourn the conference committee, and we will be at the call of the chair, which will be Representative Huntley tomorrow.